The Pushkin Speech. Pushkin is an extraordinary phenomenon, and perhaps the unique phenomenon of the Russian spirit, said Gogol. I will add, and a prophetic phenomenon. Yes, in his appearing there is contained for all us Russians something incontestably prophetic. Pushkin arrives exactly at the beginning of our true self-consciousness, which had only just begun to exist a whole century after Peter's reforms, and Pushkin's coming mightily aids us in our dark way by a new guiding light. In this sense, Pushkin is a presage and a prophecy. I divide the activity of our great poet into three periods. I speak now not as a literary critic. I dwell on Pushkin's creative activity only to elucidate my conception of his prophetic significance to us, and the meaning I give the word prophecy. I would, however, observe in passing that the periods of Pushkin's activity do not seem to me to be marked off from each other by firm boundaries. The beginning of Eugene Onegin, for instance, in my opinion, belongs still to the first period, while Onegin ends in the second period, when Pushkin had already found his ideals in his native land, had taken them to his heart, and cherished them in his loving and clairvoyant soul. Pushkin was always a complete whole, as it were, a perfect organism carrying within itself at once every one of its principles, not receiving them from beyond. The beyond only awakened in him that which was already in the depths of his soul. But this organism developed, and the phases of this development could really be marked and defined, each of them by its peculiar character and the regular generation of one phase from another. Thus to the third period can be assigned those of his works in which universal ideas were preeminently reflected, in which the poetic conceptions of other nations were mirrored and their genius re-embodied. Some of these appeared after Pushkin's death. And in this period the poet reveals something almost miraculous, never seen or heard at any time or in any nation before. There had been in the literatures of Europe men of colossal artistic genius, a Shakespeare, a Cervantes, a Schiller. But show me one of these great geniuses who possessed such a capacity for universal sympathy as our Pushkin. This capacity, the pre-eminent capacity of our nation, he shares with our nation, and by that, above all, he is our national poet. The greatest of European poets could never so powerfully embody in themselves the genius of a foreign, even a neighbouring people, its spirit in all its hidden depth, and all its yearning after its appointed end as Pushkin could. On the contrary, when they turned to foreign nations, European poets most often made them one with their own people, and understood them after their own fashion. Even Shakespeare's Italians, for instance, are almost always Englishmen. Pushkin alone of all world poets possessed the capacity of fully identifying himself with another nationality. Take scenes from Faust, take The Miserly Knight, take the ballad Once There Lived a Poor Knight, read Don Juan again. Had Pushkin not signed them, you would never know that they were not written by a Spaniard. How profound and fantastic is the imagination in the poem A Feast in Time of Plague. But in this fantastic imagination is the genius of England. And in the hero's wonderful song about the plague, and in Mary's song, our children's voices in the noisy school were heard. These are English songs. This is the yearning of the British genius, its lament, its painful presentiment of its future. Remember the strange lines, "Once as I wandered through the valley wild." It is almost a literal transposition of the first three pages of a strange mystical book written in prose by an old English sectarian. But is it only a transposition? In the sad and rapturous music of these verses is the very soul of Northern Protestantism, of the English heresiarch, of the illimitable mystic with his dull, sombre, invincible aspiration, and the impetuous power of his mystical dreaming. As you read these strange verses, you seem to hear the spirit of the times, of the Reformation. You understand the warlike fire of early Protestantism, and finally, history herself. Not merely by thought, but as one who passes through the armed sectarian camp, sings psalms with them, weeps with them in their religious verses from the Quran, or imitations from the Quran. Is there not here a Mohammedan? Is it not the very spirit of the Quran and its sword, the naive grandeur of faith and her terrible bloody power? And here is the ancient world. Here are Egyptian knights. Here sit the gods of earth, who sat above their people like gods, and despised the genius of the people and its aspirations, who became gods in isolation, and went mad in their isolation, in the anguish of their weariness and to death, diverting themselves with fanatic brutalities, with the voluptuousness of creeping things, of a she-spider devouring her male. No, I will say deliberately, there never had been a poet with a universal sympathy like Pushkin's. And it is not his sympathy alone, but his amazing profundity, the reincarnation of his spirit in the spirit of foreign nations, a reincarnation almost perfect, and therefore also miraculous, because the phenomenon has never been repeated in any poet in all the world. It is only in Pushkin. And by this, I repeat, he is a phenomenon never seen and never heard of before, and in my opinion, a prophetic phenomenon, because herein was expressed the national spirit of his poetry, the national spirit in its future development, the national spirit of our future, which is already implicit in the present, and it was expressed prophetically. For what is the power of the spirit of Russian nationality, if not its aspiration after the final goal of universality and omni-humanity? No sooner had he become a completely national poet, no sooner had he come into contact with the national power, than he already anticipated the great future of that power. In this he was a seer, in this a prophet. For what is the reform of Peter the Great to us, not merely for the future, but in that which has been and has already been plainly manifested to us? What did that reform mean to us? Surely it was not only the adoption of European clothes, customs, inventions, and science. Let us examine how it was. Let us look more steadily. Yes, it is very probable that at the outset Peter began his reform in this narrowly utilitarian sense. But in course of time, as his idea developed, Peter undoubtedly obeyed some hidden instinct which drew him and his work to future purposes, undoubtedly more vast than narrow utilitarianism. Just so, the Russian people did not accept the reform in the utilitarian spirit alone, but undoubtedly with a presentiment which almost instantly forewarned them of a distant and incomparably higher goal than mere utilitarianism. I repeat, the people felt that purpose unconsciously, but felt it directly and quite vitally. Surely we then turned at once to the most vital reunion, to the unity of all mankind. Not in a spirit of enmity, as one might have thought it would have been, but in friendliness and perfect love we received into our soul the geniuses of foreign nations, all alike without preference of race, able by instinct from almost the very first step to discern, to discount distinctions, to excuse and reconcile them, and therein we already showed our readiness and inclination, which had only just become manifest to ourselves, for a common and universal union with all the races of the great Aryan family. Yes, beyond all doubt, the destiny of a Russian is pan-European and universal. To become a true Russian, To become a Russian fully, in the end of all, I repeat, means only to become the brother of all men, to become, if you will, a universal man. All our Slavophilism and Westernism is only a great misunderstanding, even though historically necessary. To a true Russian, Europe and the destiny of all the mighty Aryan family is as dear as Russia herself, as the destiny of his own native country, because our destiny is universality, won not by the sword, but by the strength of brotherhood and our fraternal aspiration to reunite mankind. If you go deep into our history since Peter's reform, you will already find traces and indications of this idea, of this dream of mine, if you will, in the character of our intercourse with European nations, even in the policy of state. For what has Russian policy been doing for these two centuries, if not serving Europe, perhaps, far more than she has served herself? I do not believe this came to pass through the incapacity of our statesmen. The nations of Europe know how dear they are to us. And in course of time, I believe that we, not we, of course, but our children to come, will all, without exception, understand that to be a true Russian does indeed mean to aspire finally to reconcile the contradictions of Europe, to show the end of European yearning in our Russian soul, omni-human and all-uniting, to include within our soul by brotherly love all our brethren, and at last, it may be, to pronounce the final word of the great general harmony, of the final brotherly communion of all nations in accordance with the law of the gospel of Christ. I know too well that my words may appear ecstatic, exaggerated, and fantastic. Let them be so. I do not repent having uttered them. They ought to be uttered, above all now, at the moment that we honour our great genius who by his artistic power embodied this idea. The idea has been expressed many times before. I say nothing new. But chiefly it will appear presumptuous. Is this our destiny, the destiny of our poor, brutal land? Are we predestined among mankind to utter the new word? Do I speak of economic glory, of the glory of the sword or of science? I speak only of the brotherhood of man. I say that to this universal, omni-human union, the heart of Russia, perhaps more than all other nations, is chiefly predestined. I see its traces in our history, our men of genius, in the artistic genius of Pushkin. Let our country be poor. But this poor land Christ traversed with blessing in the garb of a serf. Why then should we not contain his final word? Was not he himself born in a manger? I say again, we at least can already point to Pushkin, to the universality and omni-humanity of his genius. He surely could contain the genius of foreign lands in his soul as his own. In art, at least, in artistic creation, he undeniably revealed this universality of the aspiration of the Russian spirit, and therein is a great promise. If our thought is a dream, then in Pushkin, at least this dream has solid foundation. Had he lived longer, he would perhaps have revealed great and immortal embodiments of the Russian soul, which would then have been intelligible to our European brethren. He would have attracted them much more and closer than they are attracted now. Perhaps he would have succeeded in explaining to them all the truth of our aspirations, and they would understand us more than they do now. They would have begun to have insight into us, and would have ceased to look at us so suspiciously and presumptuously as they still do. Had Pushkin lived longer, then among us too there would perhaps be fewer misunderstandings and quarrels than we see now. But God saw otherwise. Pushkin died in the full maturity of his powers, and undeniably bore away with him a great secret, into the grave. And now we, without him, are seeking to divine his secret.